I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, I have two writers in the studio. That's right, not one writer today, but two writers, and among them, many, many books that they've written. I have the poet Dawn Lundy Martin. She is the author of many books of poems, including A Gathering of Matter, A Matter of Gathering, which was selected for the Kav Kanam Poetry Prize by Carl Phillips, who we had on the show many years ago. She is also author of another collection called Life in a Box is a Pretty Life, and her latest book, which is called Good Stock. She is in the studio today, along with a writer friend of hers, Angie Cruz. Angie is a very well-known fiction writer. I've read all her books. I think she's fantastic, and I'm really glad to meet her in person. We've been Facebook friends for years. Actually, I think we met in AWP at that big writers conference many years ago. But she's here today in the studio. She is the author of two novels, Soledad and Let It Rain Coffee. These two fantastic writers, a poet and a fiction writer, are passing through town on their way to do a series of readings. And we're going to talk a little bit about being wandering writers, what it's like when you have to wake up in a hotel room and pull out your laptop and write in the lobby, or do you write in the bed, or do you go out to a Starbucks and do your writing there? They're also professors of creative writing, and we're going to talk about them right here in the studio, so stick around. When we get back, they will be right here sitting across from me. Dawn Lundy Martin and Angie Cruz, welcome to the studios at Words on a Wire.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, you guys are
passing through town on your way where?
We are on our way to Marfa, Texas.
Uh-huh. And what do you plan on doing there?
Well, I am doing a reading at the St. George at the Marfa Book Company.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a part of like a continuum of activities and
right.
has to do with Open House Marfa.
Okay. And are you reading in Marfa?
No, I'm not. I'm just tagging along because I used to live in Texas. I taught in Texas A&M for 6 years, and I am going because I currently am working on these small photographic essays, little mini mm-hmm. essays. So I was thinking that I would use the opportunity to write something.
Oh, you're a photographer as well.
Not really, not seriously. I guess like I do some kind of compositions with text and image.
Mm-hmm.
It's an exercise I do when I move around. I travel a lot. So as a practice, sometimes when you're traveling, there's a lot of dead time.
Right.
And I try to use the dead time by writing these short stories on my Instagram.
I'm glad you mentioned about traveling and what you call short time, because one of the things that you guys are on the road right now. You did a reading last night here at UTEP. It was fantastic. And I'm sure you're on the road quite a bit, you know. I mean, in order for a writer to even just get her work out there, you need to travel, you need to do readings, you need to visit colleges and universities. And I'm wondering, you're both pretty productive. You have two novels out. You're coming out with a third. I'm talking to Angie Cruz right now. She has two novels out, both with Simon & Schuster. You're coming out with a third. And then you, Dawn, just came out with this book, Good Stock, Strange Blood, but you have like three other books of poems, and you're very active in the activist literary community. How do you get time to write and to do what you need to do when you're on the road, and if you're on the road so much?
You know, for me, it's really a practice of squeezing work in when I can. Like mm-hmm. over these next 2 days, I have notes from an editor on an essay that I'm writing. And so, like, I've blocked out time
right.
after we get to Marfa today to really just focus on that and not do anything else. And tomorrow to focus a bunch on that. And I think that it becomes a kind of micro practice a lot of the time for me, where I'm just, like, really directly and actively creating little time blocks where I'm not going to focus on anything else, even though all of the other stuff that one has to do like hovers around the edges and kind of like, you know, like little mosquitoes outside the net or something trying to get in.
Right.
And so I just try to ignore that and stay within the net when I make that time.
But what about your relationship with space? I imagine when you're at home and you have your workspace, it's pretty comfortable. I know that I'm very comfortable working at home with a lot of light, a particular room. When you're on the road, do you need a comfortable space? Do you look around for it, or can it just be anywhere?
You know, I actually try to just write wherever I am. I write in bed. I can write in a really dark space. We actually did a residency together at the Malay Colony in upstate New York, and we were there for a week. And, you know, in truth, it was winter, it was dark, it was raining the entire time. And the studios are a little, they're not light-filled. so they're like challenging spaces. They're not like extremely comfortable. But for me, it's just like the practice of focusing in that moment and just, you know, stripping away the rest of the world in order to make something happen.
Angie, when you're traveling, what kind of tips would you have for writers to being productive, of finding time to get your work done?
I've always moved around a lot. I've always traveled a lot. A lot of Soledad was written on a train or a bus or on a plane.
Really? Like a New York train?
Yeah, New York train, wow. Greyhound buses, planes. So I try to fit it in the interstitial spaces between all the other things I'm trying to do. But I do think it helps to carry your work around with you.
Mm-hmm.
I often have something I'm already working on. So especially to do editing. It's easy for me to edit if I have like 30 minutes and I'm waiting in between things. But yeah, I think carrying my work with me, I think I'm really good, like Dawn, to block out everything out and just say, okay, for the next day or two, all I'm going to do is think about my novel. Like, that's one of the things I'm also doing. Aside from like trying to be an observer in the world, I also try when I take a trip, because I'm a mother, right? So if I'm not mothering, I feel like I have a lot of time. And I think a lot of mothers feel the same way.
Right.
So 2 days for me could feel like 3 weeks.
Wow.
and I'll just take the time and I'll just do the work. Yeah,
it's interesting, Angie, that you say you can ride on a train or you can ride on a Greyhound bus station. And this may sound like a weird question, but what occurred to me when you said that is I'm wondering, you know, I've read your work and your language is beautiful. I just love following the voices of your characters. And then, Don, your poetry is obviously, you know, the language is incredible to follow. I mean, we're willing to go anywhere with you just on the level of language, let alone what is coming out of that language. And I'm wondering if, as you're sitting on a train or as a Greyhound, does the motion itself influence the language if you're writing a first draft?
Well, definitely for me, I feel like when I'm moving, at least, I mean, I think that there is a way that you could be paralyzed as a writer. Because you don't know what you should be doing or what's the most important thing to think about. But actually moving makes me feel that that is something productive to do, even physically, right, moving through space. And I think that helps to unlock a lot of my ideas. And so I think it's really helpful for me. Yeah.
Can you write standing up?
No.
How about you, Don?
You know what? I've never tried, but I do want to get a standing desk because sitting is really, really bad for you.
Right.
and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to like my, you know, creative practice to end up being a crippling practice.
Right.
So I think I'm actually going to try to stand and write. I've never tried it.
Well, you know, I've been writing now probably 30 years. I'm 55 years old now. And when I was a young man, I used to write laying in bed. And then I would write in an armchair. I've never liked to write at a conventional desk, but now I find myself writing standing up a lot.
With a standing desk?
Yeah, okay. Standing up a lot. And it really kind of helps. But, you know, I need, and I think a lot of writers need in order to stay productive, is some sort of routine or ways to subvert not having a routine like we're talking about right now. I'm wondering if I could ask both of you, when you're at home and you're at home for an extended period of time and you're working on a project, what is your morning routine before you write or, you know, when you wake up in the morning? A routine that perhaps keeps you productive or not?
Well, I could say like there's one consistent thing about my writing practice is that I like to write with my laptop on my lap. Mm-hmm. I either write on my phone in the notes section.
Really?
Or I write. I need the computer on my lap. It just feels closer. So, and that is my studio, basically. And I could be in bed or it could be at a coffee shop. But usually that's the way, if I have to do something creative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But no morning routine per se.
Not really. I don't think I have the luxury to have a morning routine. I'm teaching. I'm editing a journal. I'm like, I'm a mother. I have to get up. But he has a ton of activities. So I feel like I travel a lot and that throws off routine. Mm-hmm, right. So like more for me, it's the I've learned to inhabit a space of creativity through, I guess, a physical practice. Mm-hmm. So like the body has memory. Yeah. Right. And I could just fall into it.
Well, that's very inspiring. I mean, to deal with the everything you have to deal with, yet to still find space, quiet space, so you can put your laptop on your lap and write. That's beautiful. And you mentioned that you write on your phone? You write on the Notes app on your phone?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe that's one of the moments I do write standing. Like sometimes I'm waiting for a bus.
And it looks like you're texting to everybody else, but you're writing.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm just like, I'll overhear something. As you know, Soledad is like, I say that I write by ear. Sometimes someone will say something and something will catch.
Right.
And I'll start there and I'll just, you know, try to write a scene, a really fast scene.
Right. You know, I'm going to go back to that previous question about motion and this one about, you know, there's a certain different physical movement. The body is used differently when you're writing on a Notes app than when you're writing on a laptop. And I'm wondering if that difference, I'm assuming you maybe do it with your thumb, if that writing influences the way the language comes out and perhaps even the syntax.
Yeah, I think that I'm more liberated in some ways because I'm not seeing it as something permanent. It feels more processual.
Uh-huh.
And it could be more fresh in some ways. Yeah.
Right. Wow, that's really interesting.
I think. And also, usually when I write on a phone with like text, it's always in conversation with someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have a few people that I'm in conversation with in my head, and I just address them.
Well, yeah, I love that image of a writer at a train station, and to everyone it looks like they're texting, but they're actually writing their novel or poetry or something. It reminds me of that image that was circulating through pop culture about 2 years ago, where there was this man on a boat, and he was going through his phone, and a whale jumped up right there and somebody captured the picture, and it was just, you know, him and then the whale right there, and he, you know, the whale went and he missed it completely, and there, you know, it was kind of an example of how we're losing something with the you know, with that technology. And but my first thought was, what if he was writing? Because I think, you know, when writers need to carve out space, I travel a lot too, and I think I do that too. But how about you, Don? Do you have a morning routine that you do when you're home for a long period of time?
You know, I have an ideal routine. My ideal routine that I don't get to do every day would be I like to get in my body first, so I like to go for a walk or like a run, mm-hmm. and then go for a swim, and then write, because I think that I wake up really slowly.
Uh-huh.
And if I want to kind of fully, I believe in like the body mind connection, at least in
right.
from my perspective. And so if I'm really in my body and feeling really grounded, I can kind of go to that part of my imagination that feels like an opening.
Wow.
And write from there. But it won't happen generally first thing in the morning. I also have to not look at social media and not look at the news, because I feel like that can just be like an assault on
Absolutely,
the imagination.
Yeah.
And then like you're kind of caught up in this other thing, and it's hard to...
Right.
To kind of turn back to this other imaginative space.
You know, I love the way you say get in my body first, and the way you do that is through some sort of exercise or physical activity. And then that connection you make with your body and your poetry, it seems to me, you know, fundamental that if you're going to be rooted in the poem, you have to be rooted in the body in some sense. And that's really beautiful. Get into my body first. And because, you know, do you notice the difference on days when you do not exercise and or take a walk, or which is exercise, let's face it? I mean, do you notice the difference between your productivity when you do that first thing in the morning than when you don't?
I just think it's like a struggle, because for me, it's not like I'm looking for inspiration. I'm looking for a kind of like rigor and practice. Okay. And if I'm not grounded in my body, like I just find it like I'm aware of my my body in a really different way. Like I might be like, oh, like, you know, I've been sitting too much and my lower back is really now affecting me or something like that. So it becomes like a distraction instead of like a part of the whole apparatus of the imagination. Yeah, you know, it's like a disconnect or something.
Yeah, and if you wake up immediately and go on Facebook or whatever social media you use, you're immediately you're feeling your brain and you're feeling your emotions. I mean, we know the effect social media has on, you know, on what goes on neurologically, and you're separating yourself even further from the body.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking I have been kind of taking mental notes toward an essay that's really about that's a kind of has a meta aspect to it, which is like an essay. Which is that I'm trying to write about this particular personal experience, but what's really happened, all of this horrible stuff happening in the world keeps like making an intervention. Mm-hmm. And this question of how you really do that. Because I think that we're, you know, when people of color are murdered on the roadside by police and there's like 10 of those that happen in a year and you feel them, you know, it's not like you're one is disconnected from that tragedy. But then you're trying to write about something that is so not that this, you know, there are all of these questions, I think, around how that affects the writing, how that affects the work, what you're required to do in order to attend to the work, and the impossibility of it. I'm interested in trying to think through, particularly in this moment, when there are lots of horrible things to attend to and, you don't want to be the person who's like checked out,
right.
You know, you want to be politically engaged, but you also want to be your creative self and you don't want to always have to write about that horrible stuff. You know, it's like a hard negotiation.
I'm talking to Dawn Lundy Martin and Angie Cruz, who are passing through our Ciudades Gemelas on their way to Marfa for a reading. Don, I read in an interview that you did, and I think it was an online magazine called Tremolo, where you were talking about, you know, how sometimes you're motivated by anger and that anger is what helps us change things. Right now, what is angering you that perhaps might make it into your essays or your poetry? What makes you angry now?
Oh, my God. Where do I begin?
I know, that's a big question.
That's a really big question.
And there's a million things popping up in my mind.
I think that what makes me angry is the seeming impossibility for people to, one of the things, to talk to each other. It's like people in this country are living in completely different realities when it comes to language, when it comes to what happens to human beings. There's no way for us to kind of talk across that gulf.
Right.
My friend John Keane was visiting University of Pittsburgh this past week, and he was talking about this very thing. He was like, you know, when professional sports people are taking a knee to protest brutality against black bodies, there are these white folks that see it as, you know, kind of an attack on like patriotism or like the flag or something. He was like, it's like a completely different conversation and there's no way to kind of bridge that conversation. And so like I mean, there are tons of issues, obviously, that make me angry, that make me feel helpless. But I think that this thing around language is really the one of the most mind-boggling things that feels like needs to be addressed in this particular moment in this country. Like, how do we speak to each other when we're in all these different realities? You know,
I'm on Facebook and Twitter and a couple of other things, and I have on Facebook I have childhood friends, and then I have writers. And then I have professors, but sometimes the differences of opinions are so vast when it deals with people that I grew up with or people that I went to high school with. It's funny because there's more communication now, but I'm never going to hear one of those, you know, childhood friends, you know, say, yeah, you're right. Maybe it, you changed my mind. Yeah, it's there's so much communication and yet there's no communication at the same time. So what are you working on right now, Angie? What's next for you? You have two beautiful novels out. What's coming next?
Well, I just finished a book, a novel called Dominicana, set in 1965.
Dominicana?
Yes. It set in 1965 in New York City, Washington Heights. And all my novels have been set in Washington Heights and Dominican Republic. But this one in particular is addressing the ways that the first Dominicans in the neighborhood and that came during the Civil Rights Movement and the invisibility of their story within that bigger, larger narrative. So for the past 10 years, I've just been doing a lot of research and collecting oral stories to sort of put together what it must have been like to show up at that moment and negotiate all the big changes. So it's been really fun. And it also was the same year that the U.S. occupied Dominican Republic. So, so there's a lot. It's a very interesting moment in history. And so the novel is that. But the book that I'm writing, I guess that I'm most excited about now is this other book that is set in Turin, which is about the difficulty of communication. And it's an American writer who is blocked and is in Turin, Italy. She's moved to Turin, Italy through marriage, and she finds herself without a story. So she starts writing the story of an Italian, mistranslating and perhaps the culture and also the language. And it's just talking about the difficulty of translation and also the way that we make meaning based on our own experiences, despite what the actual meaning of the story that's being told to us is.
So Dominicana is already written, and this is the one that you're writing now. Mm-hmm. And when can we expect Dominicana to come out?
I don't know. Hopefully in 2 years.
And yeah, you write a lot about Washington Heights. It's clearly a very important landscape for you. And I'm wondering how you feel about from what we understand, I'm not from there. I never even walked through Washington Heights. I don't know New York too well. I'm a California guy, but the regentrification of it, is that happening as rapidly as they say it's happening?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Columbia University owned a lot of the properties and is continuously buying it. So it's become kind of a college town in some ways, and Dominicans are being pushed out, or people working class.
Right.
People are being pushed out in general. But yeah, it is happening. All of New York. I mean, it's just happening, I think, as fast as.
Absolutely. Don, what are you working on now? This book just came out, so I imagine you're still doing a book tour. Maybe I should ask you more about
this. Is the beginning
this
of the book tour. Marfa, Texas doesn't know it, but they are my book party.
Oh, nice.
I'm having, you know how people have like surprise weddings? Like they invite you someplace and then you show up and they're like, surprise, I'm getting married. I'm going to do that in Marfa. I'm going to be like, surprise, this is my book party.
You know, you have this really beautiful prologue in this book. You don't see too many prologues in poetry, but I love the imagery that's coming out of the prologue and kind of the playfulness and the dialogue. You know, it's like a question and then the answer to the question. And I understand that the prologue was written after the text and at the request of the editor. How did happen?
I think that there's a lot to grapple with in this book, and especially given that it's there are lots of different forms and genres at work, and that part of the book comes from a libretto. And part of that libretto was in the previous book that I wrote, Life in a Box is a Pretty Life. And so I think that the editors really wanted to give the readers some kind of way of thinking through what they were about to experience. And so part of it is like dreamlike. I think there's, like the language of the tendril in that first bit, the prologue, feels like a kind of attempt to put to image the experience of creativity as it attends to, some of the material in this collection.
That image is just beautiful. He says, this book is like a long, thin, wavy tendril stretched into the sky from a small spot at the top of my head. At the end of the tendril, somewhere far in the sky where I cannot see, is a mutilated black face. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful image. I mean, I'm wondering if there was any what your relationship to visual art is, to painting, and if perhaps these images, you picture them as a canvas or maybe even have been influenced by canvases.
I'm in conversation, I think, a lot of this work and a lot of the work over the past three books or so with the visual arts. And in my previous book, it begins actually with a long poem that is, kind of thinking through a piece by Claudia May Weems. And in this book, the cover is Ellen Gallagher, who's and she actually did the cover from, I selected a work of art for the cover of my first book by Ellen Gallagher. So this is the fourth book, and it's also by Ellen Gallagher. So I think that the work is in conversation with visual art because I like the non-linguistic way that, especially Black women visual artists that I'm interested in, Kerry Walker, Kerry Mae Weems, and Ellen Gallagher, are grappling with what it means to be a Black person in social space, and they do it in a non-linguistic way, or sometimes the language is juxtaposed against the mm-hmm. image in a way that kind of complicates both. And I think that the images that I'm producing in this work kind of do that too, you know? Like, it's not like you have a clear, for the most part, narrative across the work that you can kind of access. And so there are like these visual effects that I want to produce that I hope produce for the reader some kind of emotion or some kind of emotional effect as opposed to images that do a very different kind of work.
Well, your editor in this case certainly was right about that choice. It's the first thing I read. I'm sure the first thing, you know, a lot of people will read when they open Good Stock, Strange Blood. But it pulled me into the book right away. And I felt like it didn't want me to go. I think I felt like I was hooked
on that
little string.
I love that, yeah.
Angie Cruz, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. And Don Lundy Martin, now after Marfa, you're going to return to the University of Pittsburgh. And you both teach creative writing there, right? Are your offices near each other? Do you talk a lot during the regular semester? Or do you sit next to each other at department meetings?
Funny.
Sometimes.
Oh, when we show up. No, yeah. I'm kidding.
Do you like being a creative writing professor?
Yeah, I actually really, I mean, I do. I do love teaching. And I think that I personally feel really lucky that we're at University of Pittsburgh. I mean, we have one of the most diverse faculties, I think, in the country right now. And we have like a really diverse group of MFA students. So it's really exciting for us, especially now that the program is fully funded. So that sort of creates kind of less stress on us.
Right. You were talking
and on the students.
And on the students.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, it's hard to ask anybody to come to a program, to recruit anyone and tell them, come to a program where you have to pay for your tuition and be a poet. Like, what, you know, but if they're fully funded, I think with a lot more confidence, I feel like we could take them on and sort of take them on this artistic journey together. And we have a great group of people at Pitt. So for me, it's a joy.
On the way over here, we were talking about I'm the chair of the creative writing department here at UTEP, and you were asking me, does the administration support you? And I asked you the same question, and you said, yeah, they really do. They really value us. It must be nice to be in a department that's valued.
I feel valued.
Yeah. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
Do you like teaching poetry?
You know, I do. I especially like it when the students are really smart. When they're not, I don't like it so much. No, I love it. I love teaching poetry. I actually really love teaching undergraduate poetry to undergraduate majors and minors because often they don't know that they're really good writers.
Wow, yeah.
And I read their poems and I'm like, oh my God, you know, this person's an amazing writer. And you know, and I kind of talk them through what's working in the poem and their minds are blown because they're doing something just kind of naturally without anyone telling them or showing them how to write a poem. Mm-hmm. And so I love that. That's really exciting for me.
Well, we're running out of time. I'm talking to Angie Cruz and Don Lundy Martin, but I want to leave with just kind of a really quick question. I remember encountering this quote. I think it was by Robert Frost, where he says, "A writer must either farm or else cheat his employer." His language, of course. And I've always thought about that. A writer should farm because there's seasons, or cheat our employers. And I'm wondering if you have ever, this is confession time, if you have ever taught a class and told your students to pull out a piece of paper and do some writing so you can write something down that you just needed to write down. Or if you occasionally close your office door during office hours and write. Have you ever cheated your employer in that sense?
Well, part of our work is writing, so I don't ever feel it's cheating if you're writing.
Right.
Right? Like, we're paid to be productive. in our work.
Yeah, and I mean cheating, not in a serious sense.
Yeah, but I do think like I'm just teaching and I try to be present. I mean, right. I just don't multitask it that way. I can't write in class. Right. I've never done that. Do you?
Have you ever done that?
All the time. But I think of it as a gift to the students because
absolutely.
I ask them to often write in class and then I give them a prompt and share what they just wrote. And then I do it with them. And I'm in it in the same way that I hope that they're in it. But just to show them that sometimes you'll sit down and write something in reaction to a prompt and it's really terrific. And sometimes it's really awful. It happens to everyone. And actually, out of those writing practices with my students, some poems do actually make their way into books.
And we do call it a workshop for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us. Good luck in Marfa and be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank my guests, Don Lundy Martin and Angie Cruz, for joining us on Words on a Wire, for passing through El Paso and letting us have a good conversation with them. Anytime a good writer passes through El Paso, I am going to try to get them to sit right here across from me. I love doing interviews. I don't care if it's over the phone. I don't care how far they are. We've had interviews from the Philippines, from Nigeria, all the way from Ireland. And I don't mind them because they're great talking on the phone. It's all about the voice. But there's still something about sitting across from a writer, looking him or her in the eye and having a great conversation. I certainly felt our conversation today was fantastic. So I'd like to thank them for stopping into the KTEP studios. And of course, as always, I'd love to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, who has infinite patience with both Tim and I. And makes us sound good. So thank you, Lauren. And I'll see you next week on another edition of Words on a Wire.